Hello and welcome to another edition of the Advent Podcast. I'm delighted today to be joined by our managing consultant, Dave Wharton, who is both an incredibly knowledgeable and incredibly capable lifelong security professional, having spent a career that spans both the military and civilian areas. I'm sure we're going to have a huge amount of great insight. This podcast, what we're going to be looking at is digital transformation, agile, and the whole move towards joining up systems and helping us to get more out of our databases than we previously could. Dave, good morning and welcome.
Morning, Mike, and thank you very much for having me here today.
Right. So I can remember probably nearly 20 years ago now, the government first started talking about tell us once, the idea being that we could move into any organisation, give them an update of our change of details, change of address, marital status, things like that, update our passport, our driving licence and everything else with one push of a button. And two decades on, we still seem to be struggling with that. Why is that?
I think it's just indicative of how government works at the moment. Now, I've worked in this area for probably coming up to 6 or 7 years, specifically within government departments. And the experience I've had is they are so siloed away from each other that it's almost proved impossible to have that tell us once principle applied. There are difficulties in the integration of ICT systems, and even now that still persists with digital services as part of the digital transformation program. But I think also the size of some departments make it actually difficult for them to do it themselves. And certainly in my experience, it's been the case where you can tell one area of a single department of a change, and that change doesn't necessarily materialise across the whole of the organisation at that point.
So effectively end up with silos within silos.
Exactly, yes.
So is there any part of government that's tasked with overseeing that as in a more macro scale, as an umbrella approach?
I'm not specifically aware of any programmes going on in that area at the moment. I mean, the obvious people to think of would be the Government Digital Service, GDS. They are producing some really good cross-government services themselves, and if you take something like registers, they are compiling a lot of information that government and the general public themselves are able to access this sort of data. So there's almost a principle there of tell us once when it comes to that. In terms of specific programs to do this, it seems to have gone very quiet in that area at the moment. I think as they all focus on their own digital transformation.
So the GDS are the people who are really pushing the whole digital by default agenda.
Yes.
The cloud by default, effectively.
Absolutely.
They
pretty much own that on behalf of the Cabinet Office and obviously HMG as an organ, as a body itself.
Right.
So yes.
Yeah. So what are some the key challenges then towards moving towards digital transformation? Actually, let's back that off a little bit for those people who are listening to this and come into the topic new. How would you define digital transformation to start with?
Oh, crumbs. it's massive, and there's so many different facets of it. So one area of digital transformation, I think, that generates a lot of interest and to some extent some bad press, particularly when it comes from the security angle, is agile delivery. And you're stepping away from the old waterfall approach of delivering ICT projects, in a quicker, less complicated fashion, and agile. In my experience, from a security professional, actually works very well if it's handled in the right way. Mm. It's also seen a move from on-premise, third-party supported, massive IT platforms, to migrating services into the cloud, and departments taking ownership and developing those services and those cloud-based platforms themselves now, to the development of services that the general public can access when engaging with government.
That must require a huge amount of work looking at the legacy back-end systems as well then. You can't just plug a digital front end onto a 30-year-old database and say, there we go, we've now done digital transformation.
Well, you say that, but that happens, and that's and there's so many examples of that where for a variety of different reasons, some of them valid, some of them not so, that, you know, that's exactly what's happened. And it's, you know, certainly in the early days, and like I said, I've been involved with, you know, with one particular department since 2013, I was going to say 2014, but it was actually 2013 when I started, that we were seeing exactly examples of that. Taking an old form-based submission approach, creating a nice website to replace that, but actually replacing a 40-page form with 40 web pages, just because the back-end system hadn't been changed and wasn't able to handle anything else other than the data being presented in this way.
So really, for this to be effective, you've not just got to replace one process with another, you've got to be prepared to say, actually, we're going to completely re-engineer the process and make it digital. You can't just move a paper form and turn it into an electronic form. No. That's not digital transformation.
Not at all. No, it's got to be that full end-to-end transformation. You know, looking at the process, looking at what actually do we, what's the end goal of this? What do we want to achieve? What's the requirement? And then saying, well, we need somebody to inform government of a death, of a change of circumstance, of whatever it might be, file a tax return, and, you know, then looking at, okay, so this is the information we need. Previously, we've asked for this. You know, we've realised now that we don't actually need it. Therefore, you know, this is what we now do. This is the information we ask the general public for. We reuse information that we might already have in a much more sensible, joined up way. And therefore, we're not repeatedly asking somebody using a digital service for the same information.
That makes a lot of sense, because I know the number of times I've had to deal with both local government and central government filling in forms, and I'm thinking, you must already have this information. Yeah. You know, there's so much. I know when I moved house recently, having to apply for council tax, and then I had to fill in the same amount of information to go on the electoral roll, and then to get my bins set up. And you sort of think, well, hang on a minute, you must have a huge amount of this information already. Why are they asking for it?
Well, I think that's definitely the perception. And I think, you know, people think that there's a large number of people out there who believe that, yeah, government host all this information about them as individuals, but actually a lot of the a lot of cases it's just not the case. And also the other factor of this is, obviously, you know, departments have not been that good in the past of sharing information that they hold about each other, and I think there's also an expectation from the general public that actually sometimes I don't want government departments sharing information about me for a variety of different reasons. Perhaps they don't want DWP telling HMRC in case HMRC suddenly land them with a massive tax bill. You know, but yeah, there's a perception there, and there's an expectation that actually, you know, government departments are going to safeguard information in an appropriate way and not share it unduly.
I suppose we have, say about perception, but I suppose we have this perception across all public services, don't we? You know, we talk about the police, mm-hmm. but actually it's, you know, 46 individual organisations. We talk about the NHS, mm-hmm. but actually it's 100-odd individual organisations. Mm-hmm. And then we think about the government, but actually the government is a myriad of individual organisations.
Yeah.
So, you know, in order for us to achieve Teller's wants, at some point we're going to have a bridge across all of those organisations.
Absolutely, yeah, and I struggle to see that in the foreseeable future. I think in some areas of government that will happen sooner rather than later, but I think it'll be driven by the current terms in divisions is not the right word, but we look at central government, we look at local government, we look at the police, and we look at the NHS as separate entities. Rather than being kind of the entire public sector, as it were, and I think the divisions of that nature will continue for the foreseeable future.
So, if an organisation is at the start of this journey, why would they want to push forward and do digital transformation? What's the benefit to them? What's the benefit to the citizen?
I think the immediate benefit to both is it saves money. Yeah, and I don't think there's any getting away from that. I think, you know, if done correctly, if using modern technology, the cost savings are there to be seen. And there's no doubt about that, which ultimately should lead to tax cuts, if nothing else. You know, so whether that's local government in terms of council tax, whether that's, you know, central government in terms of PYE and things like that, then I think, yeah, ultimately that journey will see those benefits materialising. And that's got to be a good thing, ultimately. I think also in terms of security, which is obviously where our hearts lie, the benefits are there to be enjoyed as well, because you know, the digital transformation process actually makes organisations look at their processes, their full end-to-end processes, makes them look at how they are holding data, how they're storing data, how they are protecting data. And with the Data Protection Act and GDPR, then it's actually, you know, making organisations think, we shouldn't have this data anymore. We should have got rid of it a long time ago. And that in itself has got to be a good thing, because, you know, the less data organisations hold about, you know, everybody, the less likelihood there is then of breaches occurring and that sort of thing.
I suppose there must be a tendency, I mean, I've seen it across all sorts of organisations, just to hang on to information, you know, just in case, yeah. Or it might be coming handy later, or sometimes it's a misnomer that actually we don't know if we can get rid of this, so we won't. But it sounds like a huge change programme, and everywhere I've worked where there's big change programmes going, there's also cultural shift that has to happen, attitudes, behaviours, you know, getting senior people to buy into a completely different way of working is to my experience, a huge challenge. How's that been in the digital transformation space?
I've actually found that relatively straightforward. Certainly in the areas where I've been working with this, I think the buy-in has been there from the senior level, the director level, and that sort of thing. I think mainly coming back to the point I made a few minutes ago, because the cost savings are there and are obvious. But I think the challenges tend to be with, you know, kind of lower down in you know, the middle kind of management levels. And also within the security profession themselves, there's always been a reluctance, particularly when you start talking about cloud services and things like that. There's a perception within some areas of the security profession that if we put stuff in the cloud, particularly public cloud, then we are taking greater risk. And to some extent, that is true. You know, there is a degree of risk there. You are entrusting, you know, your IT provision, the data that IT is processing, you know, with your cloud service provider. But equally, you do benefit from a lot of expertise that they bring to the table with this. And that, you know, that manifests itself in a whole number of different ways.
That's challenging. A lot of legacy thinking, though, isn't it, around risk management versus risk avoidance?
Definitely, yeah.
You know, we've both seen it across a whole range of sectors, not just the public sector, when it comes to security, mm-hmm. that the option is to avoid risk and uncertainty because that keeps you in a job.
Yeah.
So I guess asking security people to suddenly be prepared to accept risk, take risks even, with information by moving into an unknown platform like cloud must be very uncomfortable for them as well.
I think it has been for some, and I think it's definitely made them step out of their comfort zone and I think learn and grow as well, because too often and even recently, you know, there's a desire to say, right, this is what we do on premise at the moment. You know, we have our firewalls, we have our separation, we have our cross domain security, we have our security domains all established. We're going to move into the cloud, but we're going to do all of that in the cloud. And that's not how cloud security architecture is designed to be.
Right.
You know, if you suddenly decide that you want firewalls, you know, segregating your you know, internet facing domain, you know, and it's got to be, you know, there've got to be certain firewalls of a certain configuration. Then you have your data tier, you have your presentation layer, you have your data layer, you have your business logic layer. You, in my experience, don't necessarily then get to enjoy the full benefits, and it's certainly not transforming what is currently being done into the most cost-effective, secure way of doing it.
So that's exactly what we were saying earlier about the form, though, isn't it? It's not just about taking a form and turning it into a digital form. You've got to transform your way of working.
Exactly.
And that's the same when we're talking about the security architecture and the data management and the data process and everything else. Mm-hmm. You can't just take your existing way of doing it, shove it in the cloud and expect it to be a replica of what you used to do on-premise.
Exactly, yeah. And actually, one of the benefits, as you know, I was talking about as well, in terms of security architecture, actually you move from a position where you have one FireGuard as a firewall blocking or guarding the front door to a situation where in the cloud you actually have firewalls deployed everywhere. I mean, they're not called firewalls; they're called different things. But you know, they are right down to kind of the microservice level, able to determine who can communicate with what. And I don't want to get too technical here because it'll get very boring very quickly. But you know, it does allow a great level of flexibility and a great level of security than we're previously used to, because once your firewall guarding your front door is compromised, everything else potentially therein is compromised until it hits the next firewall.
Which is where so many of the data breaches we've seen in the past have exactly happened. That's exactly it, isn't it? They breach, and actually in many cases don't directly breach the firewall, but come in through side portals and supply chain and other mechanisms. And of course, once you're inside, you run riot all over the place then.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me from what you're saying there that not only can we achieve an equivalent level of security to what we've expected in the past, but actually we can have a greater level of security. But with greater security, historically, there came compromises in functionality. Mm-hmm. So is that still the case in the new way of working?
I don't believe so, no. I think we're seeing an increase in functionality. We're seeing departments, particularly central government departments, able to do things with technology now that they would never have considered 10 years ago. The use of BYOD in departments is a great example.
Bring your own device.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, yes, yeah. Particularly, coming from my background when I was in the military, would never have entertained that idea at all. But actually, when you think about the requirements, when you're thinking about what it is we want to achieve, and in particular, as part of a digital transformation program, being able to attract the best people in terms of web engineers and infrastructure engineers and people like that, who are at the heart of a cloud-based digital transformation program, then allowing them the flexibility to use their devices and not have to use a lockdown managed device that has whitelisted access to the internet, so they can't get easy access to the tools. It actually inhibits their ability to produce really good results, and it is actually a deterrent to attracting the best people in some cases.
You say attracting the best people. I mean, we've heard a lot over some years now, people talking about skills deficit and a whole range of technical skills, coders, developers, security, architects, pretty much if it's within the technical space, there's a skills gap there. Yeah. So how easy is it for government to attract those people away from, I don't know, for example, the private sector, or are they just like pinching off each other all the time?
It has proved challenging for some departments, particularly for those departments that are based outside of London, or some of the kind of the IT hotspots around the UK. So there has been challenges there, but I think some of the departments realised this early on and have started some really good apprentice schemes. I think of HMRC specifically here when I was reading about what they're doing in the apprentice space, and they've attracted some real talent, young talent coming in, and have given them a very clear structure for qualifying as software engineers or web application developers or infrastructure engineers and even security engineers as well working in this space. And it's proving dividends for the likes of HMRC and the other departments who've done exactly that.
That must be quite novel though in government. I can't, if you go back a decade, that's not something that most government departments would even have thought of doing.
Not in this area, not in certainly IT delivery, but it's helped address this issue. And coming back to one of the questions you asked me at the start of this little piece, Mike, was attracting the talent. Obviously, the best talent, they earn, relatively good wages.
Because government is not renowned for being the best payer.
Definitely not, no. And even, there's disparities within government themselves where, they will offer these roles at different grades and therefore which attract different salaries.
From one department to another.
Exactly, yeah, yes. which is I was going to say a crazy situation, but it's. I mean, where I come from, you'd say it's daft.
You're going to go through the apprenticeship scheme with one department and then jump to the best payer in there, which is, I suppose, is effectively mirroring what happens in the private sector anyway.
Possibly,
isn't it? Supply and demand.
Yeah,
and the best always attract the best salaries, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But certainly, it just with an expansion of this in government, I can see that whole skills deficit area becoming an increasing challenge, not a decreasing challenge, I suppose.
Yes, and like I said, there are some initiatives to going on to address that. The apprenticeship schemes are a really good example of that. But it's always going to be a factor. The private sector is always going to pay more than the public sector, and so then you've got to look at how do we retain the people who we've trained up, and obviously investing in those people, giving them a career structure. And processes like that will help in that.
That's got to be a big disruptor as well, though, hasn't it? Because the historic model of you go into the civil service and then you stay in the civil service, with the sort of jobs we're talking about here, and even jobs like we do, actually the lure of moving from public sector to private sector is going to be quite big.
Yes.
What about people moving in the opposite direction? Are you seeing much flow of people from the private sector going into the civil service?
There has been a little bit of that. I think it's certainly there's a bit of a split, and I think that government do still see talent coming in, but I think there's definitely more that leaves ultimately, but again, I think certain departments are wise to that and are looking at how they address that, because it used to be you join the, I think as you just said, you join the civil service and you've a job for life, but I think there's more and more people appreciate the skills sets that they've developed whilst working within the department. And are moving on to enjoy the benefits of the private sector in terms of salary and things like that as well.
But it feels a bit like a lower league football club. That you bring your best sports people through your academy. They have a couple of seasons. They get talent spotted, and you have to start all over again.
Yeah, but I think that applies to the public or the private sector. I don't count myself as one of these because I've had two jobs in my life. Mm. One of them's for the Royal Air Force, and one of them's for Advent IM. I don't feel the need to move around, but it is very common. You see within central government, you see people moving within departments because the jobs are out there, and that's why digital transformation is such a an appealing thing to central government, because the opportunities it opens up, and it's not just about web engineers. There are opportunities for security professionals out there. There are opportunities there in terms of user research, which once upon a time a government department would put a website up there and this is how it is, without any thought to how would a customer coming in to use that website, what would their experience be of using that website?
Okay, so user research being...
Yeah, so it's exactly that. It's exactly what it's, you know, what it says in the title. It's engaging with the general public, with customers.
So people like us who are going to use the service exactly, that's being provided.
Yeah. And you know, using, you know, their feedback to generate really good quality, and in this particular example, web pages that are clear, that don't cause confusion, and you know, and don't mean that I can't do what I want to do with this particular website, therefore I'm going to pick up the telephone and contact a help desk.
Say one of the things that always frustrates me is when I get onto a website that's asking me for information, I get halfway through and then it says you'll now need this.
Yes.
And I think, and then you've got to close it all down, go and find the document they're asking for and start the whole process again.
Yeah, and you're thinking, why didn't they tell me this right at the beginning? Well, and that's exactly what user research is there to draw out, is those sorts of experiences. Is before you go any further, we are going to need this amount of information from you.
So it's reducing the opportunity for user frustration.
Exactly.
And
yes. Yeah.
Make sure, you know, functionality is more intuitive, I guess.
Yeah.
That's got to be really new though to government, isn't it? Because I mean, I've been using government services for years, and I've never ever seen an instance where I've been asked, "What do you think about this web page or this form?" Or
well, and now in fairness, you know, to the central government departments, you know, they invest a lot of money in exactly that now. And you know, I use the HMRC personal tax account, and you know, there are a number of opportunities there where they ask you for feedback on your experience of using that website. And obviously departments also, they do go out and they knock on doors, and they, you know, they arrange to do specific user testing with individuals to get exactly that sort of feedback.
Because the means of access is huge now as well, isn't it? And, you know, once upon a time, if you wanted to do something online, you sat down at your computer and you did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're talking about a whole range of devices and operating systems, you know, tablets and phones and all sorts of devices that can be used to access these services. Does that require different thinking for different devices, or is it a very similar process? Or,
well, again, as part of the user research, as part of the technical development of a digital service, that's exactly what they do. You know, everybody that I've encountered working in this space have appreciated there are so many different ways now of being able to access a digital service, you know, and also the fact that a lot of that access is not going to be during core business hours. You know, it might be when, you know, somebody might be filing their self-assessment return on a beach in Florida, you know, or using their tablet. So, you know, being able to...
We don't pay Dave enough to go and do his tax return in Florida, by the way.
That was the first thing I thought of. That might be sunny in January. So but that, you know, that's an awful lot of effort goes into drawing out that detail and appreciating. As I said, you know, people are using smartphones, they're using tablets, they're using PCs. There's a whole myriad now of engaging with government. And it's a 24/7 operation. It's not a, you know, a core hours kind of, you know, 9 to 5 type process.
So presumably that, from an organisational perspective, that again ticks a box of cost savings because we're not having to have 24-hour call centres.
Yeah.
But also from a citizen perspective, it means you can interact with government when you want to.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not having to take time off work or fit it in around school run or, you know, people like us who, you know, we're often on site or we're travelling a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often the spare time we do get to do these things is out of core hours.
Yeah.
So that's going to drive customer engagement and get more people to use digital services that way.
Exactly, yeah. Which you then see the cost savings, you know, which is, the, you know, as I said before, one of the main driving forces for doing this. And the nice thing about all of this as well, and particularly where I've been involved in my own personal experience, is they've not forgotten to engage with security. When doing all of this, you know, they've embedded you know, security information risk people in the teams doing this digital transformation, and you know that has helped where you know some of the pitfalls around the likes of using agile delivery, you know, who are working kind of these, you know, 2-3 week sprints to develop a, you know, a core piece of functionality, rather than kind of doing a massive project over an 18-month period.
I've always thought it was preposterous that you would run a project for a year or 18 months or even 3 years and then look at the security right at the end of the project.
Yeah.
You know, certainly for my entire career, I've always advocated that security is something that's business as usual and you do it ongoing. So embedding that into, as you're describing there, in Agile, which is a ongoing thing week by week,
yeah,
has to be of a benefit to everybody.
Oh, it's a huge benefit. It means that the engagement with the security people is done at the right time. It means security can keep pace with the project delivery, and it means that security is not getting the blocker tag applied to it, because they, you know, the project team have come to security at the end of the project, as you've just said, and said, oh, you know, we think we need to do something about security, but we're going live in 2 weeks.
Like putting a lift into a building just before you're about to go live with the building. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. You know, there are things that have got to be done. There's governance, which nobody ever really likes, but you know, it has a valid, you know, purpose. But for me, it's about helping the delivery teams themselves get it right first time, and then not have to re-engineer security into a program, which ultimately is going to cost time and money and effort more than what it would have done being done at the beginning and during the process.
So that all of this is ultimately going to, as I see it, is going to result in a lot more transparency to us as citizens about the data that government has got about us.
Yeah.
But that, from what I've experienced over the years, means that we're going to get to see how good the data is that government has about us. So, you know, there must be certain challenges here around long-term legacy data and finding a way to make it accurate, you know, maintaining its integrity before you surface that to the end user. Because certainly, if I see my data, I'm going to know whether it's up to date or not, and I have an expectation that's going to be up to date, right?
Yeah. Of course, yeah, and I think again this transformation is helping with that. I think that some areas of government have got a ways to go in terms of being able to guarantee that the data they hold is good quality data, is accurate, and reflects, you know, the citizen that they hold that information about. I think part of the transformation process is that people have had to look long and hard at the data that they hold, why they hold it, do they need to hold it, and all of this has happened actually incidental of the likes of GDPR and the Data Protection Act, because it's just been an integral part of that transformation program. Because as I said, you know, if digital transformation is going to be done correctly, it is that end to end process, and it's no point having a really good digital front end, website presenting this, if actually what we're returning back is low quality, you know, poor data that is inaccurate, because that again just generates more calls to the help desk, and it slows down that the cost saving sides of things. And
yeah, because like I was describing before, if I'm wanting to interact with government, I'm, as I am at the moment, filling in a form thinking, well, you must already have this. What I'm really thinking is, you must already have this and it must be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm expecting it to be up to date. I'm expecting them to have the right information about me. And so if we're going to stop asking for that information and rely on the information we've got,
It's got to be accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a legal requirement to have that when it comes to personal data anyway. But exactly that. Yeah. You know, if a department's going to have confidence in the data that it services via a web page is accurate, then they've got to do the hard work, do the legwork to make sure that actually what the data that they do hold is exactly that.
Creating these great services, and we're saying you used an example there of the. The personal tax account.
HMRC's personal tax
account. Which, as I've understood it, will allow us effectively to manage our tax affairs the same way we manage our bank accounts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, what's the feeling out there amongst the general citizens about this? As a,
I mean, I'm not personally privy to any of that. The feedback from that, it's out of outside an area where I work. But for as a user of the personal tax account, as somebody who's logged in and seen it, the data that is all you know, my PAYE data is presented to me, my national insurance contributions are presented to me, and any other forms of income for that matter are included in that. So I can see, you know, how much tax I've paid. I can see whether or not I'm due a rebate from HMRC for that particular year.
But you're actually saying the tax man's going to tell us we're owed money.
HMRC get a bad press, but I think when they do owe you money and they realise that they are pretty good at doing that, you know, notwithstanding, of course, that the other more sinister side of things with all the scams that go on around HMRC. But I think they do, they are pretty good at that now.
Well, if nothing else, at least I can stop relying on those phishing scams telling me I've got a tax rebate and just go into my account and see it.
Exactly, yes. You know, and that was one of the reasons why that, you know, they came up with this, you know, the personal tax account, was to provide that visibility for, you know, that sort of information. But of course there is a reliance on that information being accurate. And you know, that reliance is not just on HMRC. That reliance is on employers providing the right information to HMRC in the first place, because it is accurate within the last pay month for an individual. So yeah, you know, it's got to be accurate.
That's a great point, actually. I think if any of us have ever moved jobs, we've had that nightmare period, haven't we, where our tax code gets messed up.
Yes.
We've moved from a job where we had a car, now don't have a car, mm-hmm. or where we used to have a car, now we have a car. We don't have medical benefits anymore. Yeah. Oh, anything that will take that pain away is all right by me.
Absolutely.
So my experience of working across the public sector for the last two decades has been almost a persistent and chronic move towards outsourcing of technical services, usually to a single prime, and often, you know, a lot of services being wrapped up within a very big, complicated single contract. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you say the term agile, you're thoughts immediately turn towards being able to do things quickly.
Yeah.
My challenge whenever I've worked in a typical environment is that if you want something doing, you have to then engage with a third-party supplier. They will have a change request process. The change request process takes time and effort. You have to fill in forms, jump through hoops. They then decide whether it's something they want to do. They put it into their own internal prioritization. How do you marry up that traditional relationship, which a lot of government departments are still going to have, mm-hmm. with developing digital transformation in an agile environment?
I mean, I would like to say that's dinosaur thinking, but actually, you know, it is still a reality for some areas of government. However, I think, you know, my recent experience is actually where you know the digital transformation has been fully kind of embraced. We've moved away from that. You know, they've moved away from that. They've brought everything in house. And even though there might still be a heavy reliance on contractors to support that function, actually, you know, departments are managing the services themselves now. And using the agile delivery process, you know, they've moved away from having a massive, you know, 6-monthly kind of, you know, change to IT systems, just to patch systems, let alone do anything else in terms of functionality and address, you know, usability issues, to actually, you know, in an area where, you know, a change is instantaneous almost. You know, a team identifies a change, the product owner for that team signs off on it. The security impacting's done as well as part of that change, and then, you know, within a 2-week life cycle or less, it's done. You know, and certainly where I've been working, you know, there are, you know, up to 100, 200 changes happening on a daily basis, and it's simply because they've decentralised it. You know, they've given delivery teams and project teams the ability to do it themselves, but in a sensible way that still makes sure that security's being addressed.
So I thought for a moment that you were going to tell me that these large primes had embraced Agile and were processing change requests in the goodness of their heart rather than charging an arm and a leg every time we wanted to make a minor change to a system.
No, I think part of that digital transformation was to stop exactly that. It was to move away from the prime having complete control to a situation where actually a department could make that determination.
And we were talking about one of the benefits being cost effectiveness.
Yes.
You can't have that cost effectiveness if then every time you want to develop a new microservice or put a new change in or put a new piece of code into a digital front end, you're having to pay a huge amount of money for that to happen.
Yeah. And even to address security vulnerabilities. They exist, and they need to be addressed. I've seen it in action now where a vulnerability has been identified and it's been risk triaged, it's been assessed, and a fix for that vulnerability has been deployed the same day that the vulnerability was actually released.
That seems like a no-brainer to me. I mean, every time we see a major breach of an organisation is usually through either human error or poor patching of systems. Mm-hmm. So anything that improves that posture of an organisation has to be a good thing.
Exactly. Yeah, I 100% agree. And it is. I've seen it. I've seen it in action. That's the nice thing. Again, it's not without its own risks. There are still zero-day vulnerabilities out there. There are still issues with the code that's been written. But as I said, the ability to react once we realise there's a problem there, has improved beyond belief.
Yeah, and most,
to where we were, a few years ago.
And most security events, it's not a zero-day vulnerability that's attacked, is it?
No.
It's something that's been out there in the public domain for months or even a year at a time.
Exactly. Yeah. The NHS WannaCry ransomware attack was exactly that. Mm-hmm. Unpatched Windows systems. I was going to say there's no excuse for it, but as we know, patching should be a really simple, straightforward thing, but actually, it's complex.
You'd think after 30 years of having computers in the workplace, we'd have found a way of doing this by now, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but that's another kind of benefit of digital transformation is, the move away from kind of proprietary software to software that's developed in-house, to software that's been shared with the coding community through the government's open source software kind of process, coding in the open initiatives, and quite often it's the developer community who's saying, you've seen this code via your repository, have you thought about this, have you spotted this, and it's actually really produces some really good quality.
Should we just dump that question?
Yeah, dump that question.
Okay, no problem. Yeah. Sorry about that, Dave.
Sorry.
I just thought it might have been something that was useful to the people who weren't aware of that, but it doesn't matter. So we're just going to move on now and talk about lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
So obviously you've been very heavily involved in the whole digital transformation agenda within government for some years now.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sure at the end of the wire here is probably people listening to this thinking about digital transformation for the first time, or maybe just dipping their toes in this in the early days. What are the major pitfalls that people should consider when embarking on this journey? What sort of lessons have you learned that would be useful to other people in this area?
I think we've already touched upon one of the major areas, and that is engaging with security. I use the term security loose, in a wider sense, at the right time. I think if organisations, whether public sector or private sector for that matter, have got to engage with security at the right time. And I think if you don't have them embedded within the delivery teams, or at least give them access to security people, then we are going to end up with a situation, as we've seen many, many times before, where it's security becomes the afterthought. I think you have to have that there, otherwise, as I said, you repeat past mistakes. The issues that I've seen as a result of that just become, they manifest themselves where, websites whatever services are being delivered simply aren't fit for purpose. Whether that's for reasons to do with use of hosting and the choice of service providers, and particularly cloud. I think cloud service providers themselves. You've got to get that right. You've got to engage with them in the correct way. You've got to some extent understand the products that you're procuring from your cloud service providers. So you've got to be able to kind of articulate what the requirements are, what it is you hope to achieve through this transformation, and then overlay security at the beginning and not right. at the end.
And I guess running throughout this conversation that we've been having is to understand that it's not just taking what you currently do and dumping it online.
No, not at all. It's got to be that transformation piece. It's got to, it's got to be transformed as part of that process. Because as I said, you then start tripping over other hurdles like usability, having poor quality data. It's all got to be kind of done in a coordinated fashion so that the end requirement, the end goal is met and what is delivered is secure.
Brilliant. Well, there you have it. Huge benefits to be had from embarking on a digital transformation journey. Maybe Agile will become the new world order, and in years to come, people will look back and go, waterfall what? Who knows? We'll see, I guess. Things are changing all the time. Certainly seems to me that the whole idea of Agile and digital transformation isn't something that's unique to the public sector, but is happening across all sorts of industries now. But sounds as though the public sector is certainly at the lead of this for once. I, for one, think that anything that improves access to public services, breaks down the traditional Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, turn up a kiosk and interact type of service is going to be of benefit to many of us who have much more flexible lives than that. And I think we look forward to the next few years where these services become general usage and we find out just what sort of information government actually does have about us. Dave Wharton, Managing Consultant of Advent IM, thank you very much for your time today. Anything you'd like to add to that before we sign off?
I think just to finish off on that point, Mike, actually, is just to by doing that and being able to demonstrate that it's being done in a secure fashion, it does improve customer confidence, user confidence in those services, which means that more customers, more users will use those services, which again helps drive those cost benefits.
Which is going to give us a better service overall.
Exactly. Yes.
100%. So digital transformation equals better service.
Yeah, and secure service.
And that seems like a really good point to sign off. This has been the Advent IM podcast. We look forward to catching up with you on the next one. Thank you.